Thanks for having me. Let's see. So I'll be talking about a systematic search for changing quasars, which are quasars that have shown very large changes in luminosity over time and that are associated with very significant spectroscopic variability that almost seems to be an accretion state change. But, you know, quoting from the talks earlier, maybe we should just stick with X-ray binaries and not. I should just stop here. Okay, all right, thanks. All right. So of course, yeah, we care about AGN in general. We want to understand them. So, you know, variability is one of the only ways to probe the physics of the central region. And here's a light curve of NGC 5548 RMS for typical quasars like this one. Well, this is a typical AGN. Is about 0.2 mag or 20% over year time scales. And it's aperiodic stochastic variability. And this is useful for studying physics not only through the time scales, but also through effectively resolving the central regions through reverberation mapping. And now, you know, there's some really clear cases that the UV variability contains reprocessed emission. That the optical emission contains reprocessed UV emission, and in some cases, maybe even the X-rays. So this is the composite quasar spectrum from Sloan. And this is a type 1 spectrum, because it has you know, your typical broad emission lines on top of a blue power law, which we think is thermal emission from the disk. And the broad emission lines in general for quasars are seen to be less variable than the continuum and lagged with respect to the continuum variations. So there are cases, though, where there's very strong variability in the broad emission lines. And these are so-called changing look AGN. And these have been known about for decades. So here's an example, Ferrol-9, which in 1981 had a spectrum of a type 1 quasar. I guess, in 3 years later, in 1984, transitioned from type 1 to nearly a type 2, which means, you know, you essentially still have the narrow line flux, but the broad components of the Balmer emission lines have almost completely disappeared. And this is also associated with a continuum change. So for CLAGN, I'll reserve that term for Seyfert galaxies, relatively lower luminosity AGN. And the transitions in CLAGN go both ways. So there's ones that show a dimming and a corresponding disappearance of broad components of the emission lines, as you see here. And these papers are all examples where we find disappearances of broad emission line components. And even in reverberation mapping campaigns such as Barth et al., they're seeing this sort of behavior in rare cases. And then on the right, you have examples where the AGN has actually turned on, gone the other way. So you have an appearance of a broad emission line component. And you also can have it going back the other way. So Markarian 1018 just recently was observed to transition back to its dim state that it was in 1981. So after turning into a type 1, it has now gone back, and as you see in this paper, to its faint state about 30 years later. So what's causing this behavior? There's four interpretations that I've shown here that could feasibly cause you to lose your broad components or show appearing broad emission lines in quasar spectra or galaxy spectra.
Yes. Can you limit broad lines change by the same amount in all of
so in it, by same amount, do you mean like the flux or the?
Yeah, the flux.
Okay, so yeah, you can't, it's by a different amount than the continuum, so you wouldn't be able to just like scale the whole spectrum down and cause the broad emission lines to just disappear. It's actually, the emission lines show a stronger response than you would expect if the whole thing just dimmed. Does that make sense? I'll show an example of that later. So by the way, as just historically speaking, the term CLAGN, I think, comes from the study of X-ray objects where you actually, so a paper, Rizzolitti et al., 2009, where you actually have absorption, clear evidence for absorption in the X-ray spectra, and that's causing the change of look in the X-ray spectra. So these are all objects that show a changing look behavior in the optical spectrum, which is a lot harder to explain using just an obscuration of a dust cloud that gets, or a cloud that gets in the way, because you'd have to obscure the entire continuum emitting region in the optical, which is much larger than the X-ray continuum emitting region. So you can see, this is just, you know, the conclusions that the authors came to for these objects, and you can see that most of the conclusions are that the changing loop behavior comes from a change in the ionizing continuum. So recent survey data has extended CLAGN to higher redshifts and higher luminosities. Here's just a few representative examples of CLAGN at lower redshift, and here's the luminosity of the O3 line, which can be a proxy of the luminosity. And here are the new changing look quasars that I'm going to be talking about that have been found in surveys such as Sloan and Boss and Pan-STARRS and et cetera. And I think that the two main reasons why surveys are uncovering these at higher redshifts is because of the large sky coverage, so you're finding more rare objects, and also the long time baseline that these surveys have, especially once you compare it to archival data. So the first changing look quasar, it's defined as, we'll define it as the quasar at a bolometric luminosity of over about 10 to the 44 ergs per second, was found serendipitously in the Sloan and Boss surveys. It had a spectrum in Sloan and a spectrum in Boss. Here is a light curve showing the Stripe 82 data and Pan-STARRS data, which I'll introduce later, but this paper by Steph Lamassa et al. In 2015 found that the earlier Sloan spectrum had broad emission lines, but the later Boss spectrum, shown in black here, essentially did not have those broad emission lines, and so called it a changing look quasar. And very luckily, there were archival X-ray observations in the bright state, and there are X-ray observations in the new faint state, and if you compare those, there's no evidence for variable obscuration. So it does seem that this may be related to an accretion rate change or a change in the ionizing continuum. So here's just a zoom in of the Balmer lines and the objects I showed you in the previous slide. H beta is on the left, and it loses its broad component completely. H alpha retains a small amount of the broad component, thus making it a type 1.9. If it had lost all of its broad H alpha component, it would be a type 2. And in general, this is sort of what we see. We see transitions between the type 1 and type 1.9-ish. Here's another example. This is an interesting case where, again, the quasar spectrum dimmed, and after dimming revealed this these Balmer absorption lines, which is indicative of a post-starburst galaxy. And this is interesting because, you know, now you can study the host galaxy in galaxies that host, that you know host AGN without the AGN being there, making it difficult for you to study. If you look at the narrow line fluxes here in this diagram shown below, in both states, even in the dim state, the narrow lines require an AGN to be there. And in general, the objects I'll be talking about do require an AGN to be there, even in the faint state. Although there are a couple of cases where you do not require an AGN to actually be there in the to explain the faint state spectra. Okay, so a systematic search was done of the SSDSS by John Wan, who's a finishing grad student at University of Washington. And so this search was sensitive to very dramatic changes in spectra because what they did was they looked for through the Sloan and Boss database and looked for objects that changed in their pipeline spectroscopic classification from galaxy to quasar or the other way around. So this selected 117 candidates that had differing, discrepant pipeline classifications, and three of those, after a visual inspection, turned out to be clear cases of a changing lit quasar. And one of those was the Lemassa et al. Object that I showed earlier. So they recovered that object. So we took this a step further. Well, we took an alternative approach by doing a systematic search based on photometric variability, since in all cases, this strong spectroscopic variability is associated with a strong change in their continuum flux. So the photometry will reveal, you know, if something's changing by a lot, obviously. So, so we started with the Sloan data set, and here is shown the sky coverage of repeatedly imaged quasars in Sloan. You have the Northern Galactic Cap, where the repeated observations are due to mostly due to the scanning overlaps. And then you have the Stripe 82 region, where you have, you know, 70 epochs over 10 years of all the quasars. Here's the distribution of magnitude differences for quasars in the Northern Galactic Cap. And so what we did is we're looking at objects that have shown a magnitude change greater than one mag, okay, at some point in their light curve. So we're looking for things in the tails of this magnitude change distribution. And then we also include pan-STARRS data. This is essential because of, well, first, because of the fact that it gives us light curves for all the quasars in Sloan, and also because, it has similar depth to Sloan, and which is very convenient, and also it provides an extended time baseline, which is really, really useful for finding this behavior. It can occur over, like, a decade. So pan-STARRS data was very, very essential in this search. So what we started with were the Sloan quasars as defined as as a quasar that was in the DR7 quasar catalog. So it had to have, you know, been classified as a broadline quasar, which introduces some selection effects, but I won't worry about that for now. So starting with about 100,000 quasars that had Boss spectra, so repeat spectroscopy, and that showed a magnitude change of over one mag at some point in the light curve, we were left with about 1,000 objects over the sky, and about 300 of those are in Stripe 82. And then when we just look through the spectra by eye and pick out the ones that seem to have lost their broad emission line components, we came out with about 10, most of those being in Stripe 82. Stripe 82 data is just better, of course, so for capturing the, using a variability selection, your selection in Stripe 82 is going to be more pure than your selection in the NGC, so that's why the selection was more efficient in StripeDB2. But anyhow, so just some details. You know, there were some clear blazars that were radio loud and also that showed very strong variability on very short time scales, like 3 mags over months. So we don't consider those because we're not interested in blazar-like activity for this purpose. But in general, we don't exclude radio detected sources. I think out of the 10, there was only one that was radio detected.
These ratios are due for a short time scale of the variability, because the difference between StripeDB82 and the NGC is that you've got many more observations over shorter over the same period, and you find basically all your changes in the StripeDB82 data, right? So
I think it. Well, I think it has actually more to do with the contamination. So this 1,000 has a lot of contamination from bad photometry. It ended up in our sample because there was a data point, a spurious data point in PanSTARRS, say, that was an outlier, which caused it to end up in my sample. But when you have a StripeDB2 data, you know, I had a more efficient outlier rejection going on. So I think it has more to do with that. I'll go into more of the time scales later, but in general, yes, we did find some very short time scale changes. Okay, so here's an example of a light curve that we would have considered. And this case, it was flagged because of the magnitude change between here and, between here and here, okay, which is over a mag. So we didn't necessarily look for things that changed from spectral epoch to spectral epoch. I wanted to be as conservative as possible, so we just simply used, if it changed by a magnitude at any point in the light curve, we then looked at the spectral epochs. This one is at a redshift of 1.87, so we also looked at all redshifts. We didn't make any redshifts cut for this. This is a table of the changing look quasars. We did recover the Lamassa et al. Object as well, since it was in the quasar catalog, but not all of the one, not the, the two new ones from Ruan et al., because they weren't in the quasar catalog. But you can see the redshifts are all below 0.6 or 0.7. So that's probably a selection effect, because the Balmer lines, which are there in the at lower redshifts, that are, if you have to be a redshift of lower than 0.8 for the Balmer lines to be in both Sloan and Boss spectra, those were the lines that were mostly, that we found to be mostly variable. So, yeah, there's a selection effect there. But you also have things like from winds, and the magnesium line has also got some more complex things going on. the Balmer lines are more reflective of just the ionizing continuum. So they essentially just count the number of ionizing photons. In general, in the higher redshift ones, I didn't I looked through a lot of high redshift quasar spectra. I didn't see any large changes. Whether or not there was something interesting going on at the in the redder end, you know, in the infrared, I don't know. I couldn't tell.
It's just saying that less luminous quasar is variable.
That could also be it. Yeah, and we do know that there is that anti-correlation between luminosity and variability amplitude. So yeah, that could be part of it as well. That's an interesting question. Okay, and these are just the morphologies. In general, they have extended morphologies, but some of them are actually like blue point sources, your typical quasar. Here's the distribution of time scale. So this is in the observed frame. You can see the gaps due to the observing seasons. The gray data points, and which are traced by the white contours, show you the StripeDB2 versus PanSTARRS variability, photometric changes. And in red, so we make a cut here, right? So we only consider the ones that are above this line, all the gray points above this line. The black contours are showing you the Sloan, so the NGC Sloan photometry versus PanSTARRS. We consider all those that are above this line, and then if you look at just the magnitude change among spectroscopic epochs, then you plot all those candidates as red circles, and that's what you see here in red. And you can see that only a small fraction had large photometric variability among the spectroscopic epochs. So we got lucky with the timing of the spectra, in other words, for just a small fraction of these. And let me just go to the next slide, because this is showing the rest frame timescale, which smooths things out, makes it a little bit more clear. You can see the STRIPE-82 data cover a much more complete distribution of timescales than the Northern Galactic Cap quasars. So here, the sample that we found of changing look quasars are shown in blue, and they're all located sort of at longer timescales and large changes. But the longer timescale, again, probably has to do with the fact that they're all at lower redshift, so the time dilation is less. So here's an example of one that we found to turn on. Here's the STRIPE-82 light curve and PanSTARRS data in blue over here. There's some Sloan data points right there as well. The red data points show you archival photometry from Catalina, although we don't include that in our analysis. We just show it here. Here are the two epochs of spectroscopy. The first one is shown in red, and the second one later is shown in black. And you can see the appearance of H-beta and the other Balmer lines. Magnesium doesn't change as much as the Balmer lines, but it does show pretty strong variability. Here's the different spectrum. So what's nice about the different spectrum, if you just take the difference between the two, you can eliminate the host galaxy light, and you're just looking at the variable component. And it does seem to follow what you would expect for a variable accretion disk, so because it follows this new to the one-third trend in general. Here's an example that our most dramatic one that we found that turned off. And we don't have STRIPE-82 coverage for this one, unfortunately, but it does show a very strong change. And there's perhaps some other component, like coming from the Balmer continuum, that might be causing the different spectrum to differ from what you would expect from the new to the one-third. And here's an example of one that we found that actually showed both emerging and vanishing broad emission lines. It's kind of at low signal to noise. And unfortunately, the Sloan spectrum doesn't cover H-alpha. But we were lucky, though, that it happened to be on a plate that was observed several times in BOSS for increasing signal to noise. So all of these, there's actually a lot of other spectroscopic epochs that I don't show here. But the four that I have plotted here are shown by the vertical lines in the light curve. And you can see that from the photometry, it brightens and dims and then brightens again. And the rebrightening occurs on a timescale short of about a year in the rest frame. And the spectral features track these changes. So it goes from the red to black, very strong change in magnesium flux. And you essentially have no broad H-beta in the black spectrum, and only narrow H-alpha with possible broad component there, as I mentioned before, which then rebrightens into the purple spectrum that you see there. And just to zoom in on the magnesium line to show you that, it does actually show a linear response for magnesium. In general, magnesium is not seen to have a large response in quasars. And this is seen in reverberation mapping. Well, there's a very small sample of quasars that you can do reverberation mapping on that has magnesium in the spectrum, because it has to be a sort of a higher redshift. But in general, we don't see a strong response in typical quasars, but in this one we do. So this is the four epochs I showed you in the previous slide, and this is the calculation measurements that a grad student, David Holman, did in Edinburgh, where he measured the response of magnesium to the change in continuum flux. And we see a linear response, which is, you know, for a non-response, you would see just a flat line here. We see a linear response for this object, at least. Oh, okay. So there's actually 14 epochs of spectroscopy. We're only showing five here, but yeah, there's a lot of epochs.
So when you say continuum flux, it's continuum at what wavelength? Is it magnesium itself or at shorter wavelengths?
So I believe that for this measurement, he chose a region of the spectrum that was uncontaminated by any broad emission line flux. And I can't remember exactly what wavelength, but it was somewhere like, you know, out of the region where you're not going to have much of the iron lines contaminating your continuum either. Yeah, so he did a careful job at measuring continuum flux, although I can't remember exactly what wavelength. Okay, so I'm going to rush, actually, because... I wanted to get, you know, to the fun stuff for you guys. I think I've answered some of the questions already that I was going to show on these slides, so I'll just skip forward. So here's the physical properties of the sample of changing light quasars. So here's the time scales, the black hole masses, which actually stay constant from the dim to bright states. Yeah. So actually, when they dim, the lines get broader. And here are the volumetric luminosities that you see in the bright state and the dim state, shown in the asterisks show you the bright state, and then the corresponding Eddington fractions. Now, these are all based on, you know, very old black hole masses, and the uncertainties are going to be 0.3 to 0.5 dex. So they're a little uncertain, but these are, in general, what we're finding, a very large range in Eddington fractions. So I already said, you know, we can't explain it with simple reddening tests, dust reddening tests. The time scales you would expect for dust obscuration seems to be about an order of magnitude too long. Tidal disruption events could be happening, although the existence of long persistent states in the bright phase kind of seem to rule. It makes it very difficult to model these with tidal disruption event flares. So it really, it could be accretion rate changes that we're seeing. And so for accretion rate changes, you would expect to see changes occur over the viscous timescale. And so for the optical emitting region, it's about 10,000 years, but it's strong, very strongly with radius for the inner disk. And so what about? So just considering, you know, what we see in dwarf novae, these limit cycle outbursts, if you just were to scale those up, the viscous time scale, as I mentioned in the previous slide, is very long for quasars, so an order of 10 to 5 years. And so this is, you know, this doesn't seem to be what we're seeing. But if you consider this source that I think was mentioned earlier today, the outbursts in this X-ray binary were on seconds or minutes, and this scales to about 1 to 10 years in AGN. So actually, maybe there is something interesting in following up here. Also, in this thermal instability is expected to occur over year time scales in AGN, so this is a lot more consistent with the time scales that we're measuring for these objects. And when the authors for this paper on Markarian 1018 modeled the luminosity change, they could fit it with the relation L to the T fourths that you would expect for a thermal accretion disk. So this could be a large temperature change that we're measuring, although again, you have to you have to be able to propagate this, you know, throughout the disk, and that happens over a longer time scale. So maybe what we're seeing in the spectra are just, you know, kind of a very specific region of the disk where this thermal this temperature change is going on, as opposed to, you know, a global temperature change. Also, you know, there's other ways that you could get you could have thermal instabilities happening in the disk that cause the observed time scales to match what we see. So cold chaotic accretion models, as we heard about yesterday, that could lead to very fast variability. Also, as we'll hear about later, it's possible that maybe these changing quasars are at lower metallicity, and therefore they're unstable to this thermal instability because of the opacity bump effects. So I think these are good things to think about. And ongoing future work. So currently I'm following up a sample of several tens of changing quasar candidates that were flagged by having large photometric variability, but did not have spectra in BOSS. So we're getting our own follow-up spectra with telescopes such as the MMT, Magellan, and the WHT. I was going to show you a bunch of pretty spectra, well, maybe not so pretty spectra, but since in the interest of time, I'll skip over that and just mention that there is a survey going on in Sloan 4 called the Time Domain Spectroscopic Survey, where we're obtaining repeat spectra for thousands of quasars. So there's a repeat quasar spectroscopy dedicated to just obtaining another epoch spectroscopy for about 13,000 quasars. And those, of course, cover all redshifts. But there's also a sub-program where we're obtaining a few epoch spectroscopy for about 1,000 quasars showing hypervariability in their light curves, so magnitude changes of about 0.7 or more. And then also included in all these samples is about 3,500 quasars at lower redshifts, where you'll be able to measure changes in the Balmer lines. So this is good. We're now collecting data, and will be for the next couple years. This is just an example of one that we observe in the repeat quasar spectroscopy program, and it's a turn-on object, so you can barely see in any broad H-beta in the previous spectrum. And in the later spectrum in TDSS, not only does the broad components appear, but also a strong blue shift in the Balmer lines, which might be interesting. And our anticipated results are that, you know, we'll fill in the space of luminosity and time scale, and we can start to, you know, investigate, you know, how do you define a complete sample of changing quasars, and where do they lie in parameter space? Are they a rare, unique event, or are they just the tail of regular quasar variability? You know, answer some of these questions. And I'll just leave my summary up, and, I want to leave this slide up, sorry. I want to advertise a conference we're having this summer in July at the U.S. Virgin Islands, dedicated to answering these sorts of questions. And we want to pull together theorists, observational astronomers, and also experts in tail disruption events and other large AGN flares to tackle these problems. Okay, I'll end there. Thanks.
So you already have a nice sample of variability. When you go through your variable sample, throw out everything you think is just bad photometry epochs, you're left with a sample, and you could look at that as a function of mass and mass accretion rate and kind of map out the AGN variability on that plane. Have you done that?
No.
I'd love to see it.
No, and I don't know, maybe this is kind of what you're saying. So, one of the things I really want to do next is to take sample of the changing the quasars, and if for all their bright states, find similar quasars at the same luminosity, same Eddington ratio, black hole mass, et cetera, and then just compare the spectroscopic properties, and then also do that for the faint states, and see, you know, if we can see anything interesting about these objects.
That would be great.
Yes. So, you know, we know the classical picture of type 1s and type 2s as being orientation effects. So in this case, so when we have a type 1 to type 2 transition, are we saying that a type 2, a change in look type 2 is really a type 1 where something has happened to the Gordline region gas and it's just, you know, that emission has disappeared? Is that the interpretation?
I think we'd say, so there's type 2 AGN and then there's true type 2 AGN. I think we're sort of relating more to true type 2 AGN.
So why is the see a difference between a true type 2 AGN large inclination angle versus a type 2 that might be a small inclination angle where the broad line region is actually just disappeared?
Wait, I'm sorry, I'm confused. For so type 2, you don't see the broad line region.
That's right. Oh. So in a classical Antonucci picture, type 2, you're not seeing the broad line region, but in this case, in the changing look, it's really a small inclination angle, but the broad line region has disappeared. So it's still really a type 1 regarding the geometric picture. It's the broad line region somehow has disappeared.
Yeah.
So in principle, if you compare the spectra of a type 1, a true type 2 with a changing look type 2, there might be some differences that could give you hints to what's causing the change.
Yeah, that's another good thing to do. Yeah. I'm interested if, you know, following up true type 2 AGN, and do they vary like this? Yeah.
So I sort of asked you about this during your talk, but the median redshift of SDSS quasars is 1.5. The median redshift of your changing look sample is a lot lower than 1.5. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to understand what is it, your selection that is actually pushing you into lower redshifts, or is it, you know, if you had a quasar at 1.5 that varied by one magnitude, when you go and look at that, is it then not a changing look quasar, or what's going on there? Are they actually not in the sample, or?
Oh, I'm sorry, the ones that are at higher redshifts?
Yeah, it's just weird that you're selecting a sample that's got a very different redshift distribution than the population that you're searching from.
I think it's a selection effect. I think that if we could, like, magically see the Balmer lines.
But I don't understand why you think changing look has to be a Balmer-like behavior. Like, okay. If the continuum, you're seeing massive continuum changes in the blue continuum. So forget about the Balmer lines. If something changes by a mag,
okay,
and it's
got that
massive continuum change, would you call it a changing look, or do you call that something else?
No, I see what you're saying. Because we're selecting things that have changed photometrically, but when you actually look, it seems to not be, the actual lines don't seem to be changing.
But the continuum does or does not?
It does. Well, I mean, because otherwise you wouldn't have, you know, you have to somehow get the flux down. I think when you start looking at those redshifts, you know, you probably have to start, you really have to understand winds and what's actually making up your emission lines there.
So then if I understand, the reason why you're sort of focused on the Balmer lines is that in practice the Balmer lines reverberate roughly much more of the line reverberates in the Balmer lines than say the rest frame UV lines, and that's why the changing look identification becomes much more tricky.
Yeah. Right. I would agree with that.
I had a question on the timescales. Could you go back to slide, I think it was 18 or 19, where you showed the difference between the Stripe 82 with PS1 and the North Galactic, the one with the distributions. Yeah, forward. Yes, this one. Or this one, but maybe the other one.
Okay.
This one. So do I understand correctly that the black contours are the comparison between Sloan, just the North Galactic cap, and PS1?
Yes, and also if there are
repeat
images in imaging in among the Sloan photometry, then they'll be, but you know, they're often only two epochs, but yeah, those will be included as
and
well.
And the gray is just Stripe 82 would be his one.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes. So Stripe 82 versus Pan-STARRS, yeah.
Yeah. So if you take the average in the, or the median in the deviation for the black contours and the gray points, which is hard to see in this picture, are those medians the same? And also, do the gray points, are they consistent with just being the tail, the upward tail from the distribution you get in the black? Do you see my point?
Yeah, I think
so. I'm just wondering whether the Stripe 82 sample is just, you know, a more extended example from the same distribution as the larger sample, or if there is something really different there.
I think it's what you're saying. No, I you can't really see this well with the way I plotted the contours, but no, I do think that when you're looking at the northern galactic cap, the changes that you're seeing are essentially an average of what you would be seeing in Stripe 82.
But then the distribution should be the same, right? So then you're drawing from the same distribution. That's something you could check. Because then the Stripe 82 data should just be a better populated sample from the same distribution.
Yes. Yeah, I guess.
And that's what I'm wondering about.
Okay, so you would sort of check that by plotting the medians, for example, in each of
these. Well, the medians and the distribution upward in deviation from the total sample. Mm-hmm. And then check whether the Stripe 82 sample is still consistent with that distribution, yes or no. And you can do it by sort of the vertical slices that you have here.
I'm just going to look at this one because it makes more sense to me.
Because it looks to me that the median of the gray points is higher than the median of the black components.
Yeah, I agree with
that. And that would argue for the fact that they are two different distributions.
I think and this is I mentioned it earlier, but I when I looked, when I was looking through a lot of the objects in the Northern Galactic Cap, I think that there was a very large contamination, because I just use a very simple criterion for the variability. So if you had not good sampling in the light curve, it's hard to tell which ones are actually outliers and which ones aren't. Sometimes the only way you can tell there's an outlier is if you have a well-sampled light curve. So I think that if you were to get rid of all the fake, all the spurious photometry, this would shift upward. If that makes sense.
Okay, we'll talk more about it later.
Okay.
Maybe if I can ask a naive question. So what does this mean for the unification model?
Oh gosh, I don't know. Does anyone in here still? believe that it's okay. Yeah, I don't think it's very relevant for that actually, because we're not seeing transitions from type 1 to type 2. We're seeing transitions from type 1 to type 1.9. So yeah, I don't think it's that relevant.
Maybe this is a related question, but it seems like many of the cases have factors of roughly 10 in continuum changes in flux, and change from type 1 to type 1.9,
That's roughly correct.
Is that a selection effect, or is that a real thing, that these things all do similar changes in some way?
I don't know. I think, by now, especially with all the historical measurements of the CLEGN, if there was a larger range, we would have seen it by now. So I think it's real, but...
So there aren't ones that actually become type 2, where you don't see any
at all after the change? There are a couple cases, but there's also, in those cases, it's hard to, you probably should consider other models, such as a tidal disruption event or a supernovae as well. And it's more hard than you would think to rule those out. But in most cases, right, it's most likely the AGN changing.
So you had a slide where you mentioned the maximum time scales were a few years, 4 to 10 years, but what about the minimum time scales? I think that would be very interesting to know just how quickly you change by a factor of 10.
Yeah. So it's, I think it's, Right, you're going to be limited by the spectroscopic epochs, even if the photometry seems to change by shorter. You know, you don't know if the actual broad mission lines changed until you look at the spectroscopic epochs. And I think that, you know, 3 years or so is the minimum time in the observed frame between spectroscopic epochs, and maybe down to 1 year in the rest frame. My opinion is that it'd be really hard to find large changes below that time scale. But again, I think we need more data to really tell.
Fair enough, but to understand the continuum changes, you know, forget about what the broad lines are doing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think for AGN you're going to find anything significantly less than a year, you know, or half a year. Even though there is variability, there's not going to be significant variability on those short time scales.
Okay, I think we have to move on. Thanks, Chelsea.